You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. As we slowly move out of the pandemic and the pandemic-induced economic crash, you're going to hear a lot of news stories about economic growth. This mostly comes in the form of reporting on changes to the estimated gross domestic product, or GDP. And we throw these statistics around a lot without ever really taking time to unpack what they represent, what they leave out, and why some people think having them go up is a good thing. This has, in fact, long been heavily contested terrain in the fields of economics, development, and statistics. And our next guest took the time to write up an intellectual history of those contests. We thought this would be a really good time to get into it. Stephen Massacura is a professor of international studies at Indiana University Bloomington's Hamilton Lugar School of Global and International Studies. His new book is The Mismeasure of Progress, Economic Growth and Its Critics. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start with the very basics? When we toss around words like economic growth, what are we in fact referring to today?
So usually when we're talking about economic growth, we refer to the growth of the national economy. And the national economy is usually synonymous with one statistic, that is gross domestic product, GDP. And GDP is simply a measure of the total monetary value of all the production within a country's borders in a given year.
Okay. It has instantly gotten complicated. All the production within a country's borders. If I go out and buy an iPhone, parts are sourced from across Asia, assembled at a Foxconn facility in China. The profit slice of my purchase is likely to wind up with a holding company that has a tax location in Ireland. Whose gross national product does that show up as part of?
That's a really great question. In part two, because the revenues from the company that produces the iPhone are often not stored in any of the countries you mentioned, but offshore in a tax haven, totally separate from that process as well. What you've indicated, though, is that what seems like a really simple task, adding up all of the goods and services in a country in a given year, is actually rife with all sorts of technical difficulties. The diverse supply chains that you refer to indicate that the purchase of an iPhone actually contributes to the GDP of many different countries simultaneously. And yet it's also really difficult to effectively account for all of those things, in part because there's such frequency and intensity of sales and purchases going across borders. It also requires companies to keep really up-to-date information about that. And this is really a problem that takes many different forms in our contemporary landscape.
Yeah. Why don't we start with the origin story, with the metric our audience is probably most familiar with from news headlines. It's a gross national product.
GNP, the gross national product, didn't really become prominent in use until the mid-1940s during World War II. And in fact, talking about a thing called the national economy is a relatively recent invention. It wasn't until the early 20th century that people talked about the national economy in the way that we do now. Prior to that, it was a process, not really a thing. The word economy was used most often in terms of acting in an economizing way, marshaling the resources of the household in an efficient manner. There was some talk of economy as a mode of governing, so you would hear reference to war economies and things of that sort. But it wasn't really until the 1920s, then especially the 1930s and 1940s, that the national economy became a real object of focus for economists and politicians. And that was because of advances in statistical techniques. There were new ways to measure the size of national economic activity in what was known through the kind of umbrella term of national income and product accounting, of which GNP became the most prominent variety. And also because of the scale of economic challenges the United States and other countries faced during the Great Depression. When the Great Depression struck, there really weren't reliable statistics that government officials had at their disposal to get a sense of just how bad the economic situation was. They knew people were out of work, they knew banks were failing, but they didn't have a single metric that they could point to describe the state of things. And so Congress turned to economists and said, hey, can you come up with something along these lines? And out of that process came the first GNP estimates in the United States. And by the late 1930s and early 1940s, those statistics, economists argued, would become really useful if the government were to use them for budgeting and planning purposes. And so GNP only really took off at the start of World War II, when the government had to figure out how it could mobilize a lot of resources for the war effort without sending the economy back home into another recession or depression. And so it was only really in the 1930s and 1940s that GNP and GDP were first used in a significant way, in part because it was only at that time that we had the statistical techniques and the real social need for these sorts of numbers.
The conceit of any purportedly precise measurement like this is you have to be able to measure something before you can try to improve it or determine whether your interventions are having their desired effect. But it has like a secondary effect, right? Which is that you focus on the thing you're measuring to the exclusion of the unmeasurable.
Absolutely. And this was actually a really hot debate in the 1930s and 1940s. One of the main obvious issues with constructing a number like GNP is that you need data to feed into your calculations. But even more fundamentally, you need to decide what to count in the first place, what you're going to value and what you're going to call economically productive. And that's not self-evident. And so I'll give a couple of examples. The economist who's often credited with being the progenitor of GNP and was really influential in the United States in coming up with the statistic was a man named Simon Kuznets. And in the 1930s and 1940s, Kuznets was really worried that the way in which the government was calculating GNP included government spending on the military as a productive activity. And for Kuznets, this was a problem because if military spending was included in GNP, and if you treated a high GNP as a good thing, ergo, policymakers would look to military spending as a social good because it would boost GNP figures. And for Kuznets, this was not the case. He argued that it would create a perverse incentive to put huge amounts of spending into armaments and the like, without regard to whether or not it was socially necessary, simply because it made the numbers look good. And he debated that military spending should be excluded from GNP, and ultimately he lost out, and it ultimately was, and still is to this day. On the flip side, there were lots of other really important fundamental social activities that were excluded from GNP from the start. And perhaps the most infamous and important is unwaged household labor, especially that labor that's carried out most often by women. And this was an issue that really came to the fore in the 1940s as the British government began to try to come up with GNP estimates for its colonies in places like Africa and the Caribbean. What the economists they sent out to research and to come up with these sorts of estimates found was that when they arrived in the colonies, they recognized that so much of what resembled economic activity, making food, creating fuel to fuel the household, doing all sorts of services, like purchasing fuel and things like that, did not involve money changing hands, did not involve anything like market setting prices. A lot of it was subsistence oriented, that is to say, it was carried out within and by the household. A lot else was bartered, which is to say, exchange for goods that didn't involve prices. And so one of the main economists who went out and tried to construct GNP estimates for the British colonies was a young woman named Phyllis Dean. And what she argued was that even though these activities were not valued in the same way they were back in Britain, that is to say, they didn't involve money changing hands, they were still economically productive. Houses needed firewood to boil water. They needed firewood to cook the fuels. They needed people to clean clothes and garments and things of that sort. And that the basic economy of a village or a town could not sustain itself without this sort of activity. And again, even though it didn't involve prices, which was necessary for calculating GNP back home, it was still a vital activity. I mean, more to the point, Dean said that this activity was all carried out by women. And so if we excluded it from GNP, all this labor they carry out on a day-to-day basis would be quite literally devalued. And so Dean came up with an elaborate system to try to estimate the monetary value of this. She would sort of take the price of firewood in one town and extrapolate from that what it would be in a place where firewood was not bought and sold in a market. And ultimately, she came up with all sorts of ways to try to estimate the monetary value of non-monetary economic activity. But she was ultimately overruled. Her advisor in this project was a man named Richard Stone, who would go on to chair the United Nations Commission that standardized the process for GNP accounting across different national borders. And what Stone argued was that it was simply too complicated and too difficult to get reliable data of the kind that Dean had tried to do. And so unwaged labor, household labor that didn't involve prices and money would be excluded from GNP accounts. And so to this day, if you take your laundry to a laundromat and pay someone to clean it for you, that contributes to GNP. But if you or someone else in your household does the laundry for yourself and doesn't get paid for it, then it does not contribute to GNP.
I was so interested to read that this first comes up in the context of imperial powers trying to figure out how to account for their colonial possessions, because I always thought of the push to account for domestic labor as kind of part of 1970s feminism, the wages for housework campaign, Selma James, Sylvia Federici, and so forth. Were they aware of this strand from the 1940s?
Yeah, and there's a really interesting lineage where, in addition to the really important activists that you mentioned, many feminist thinkers and especially feminist economists will consciously look back to Phyllis Dean's pioneering work as a key moment when these issues are first raised, and there's something like a methodology created to try to give them value. What's interesting, though, is that there is some divergent among feminists and even within the minds of individual feminists about how valuable this kind of work ultimately is. And so to give an example, there's a really important feminist economist from New Zealand named Marilyn Waring, who writes a really popular book in the late 1980s called If Women Counted, that raises many of the issues that Phyllis Dean first did. Only now what Waring does is to show in the landscape of the 1980s all of the invidious consequences from the relative invisibility of women's household labor. In the 80s and 90s, Waring takes a track very similar to Dean, in that she, sort of following Dean, tries to come up with ways to integrate this way of accounting women's labor into conventional metrics. But a few years later, she starts to change her tune, and she begins to question whether or not that's ultimately the right thing to do on feminist principles, in part because she says to simply find new ways to incorporate and account for women's labor just ultimately creates the same sort of basic incentives that exist across the capitalist economy and contributes to a broader ideology of GNP growth as the preeminent goal for society writ large. And she comes to argue that ultimately playing this game and trying to integrate and to quantify women's labor in this way ultimately just reinforces the same overriding framework of GNP and growth, and does little to challenge the underlying power dynamics and unjust social relations produced under capitalism. And that what is instead needed is a different system of value altogether, beyond GNP and beyond conventional accounting, to point to a more sort of holistic, equitable, and just form of living.
Which, going back to the original example of Britain trying to figure out how to account for economic activity in its colonies, whether you count domestic labor that is non-monetized or not, they're still colonies.
Yeah, and it's important to point out that in this colonial case, that the British are not doing this out of some altruism or something of that sort. What they're really concerned about in the 1930s and 1940s is decolonization and independence happening on a timeline that they don't want. And so they turn to economic development as basically a carrot in the hopes of forestalling radical demands for independence. And they view this kind of statistics and quantification as the kind of necessary first step to get a snapshot of the standard of living of the colonies, so that they can then provide just a modicum of economic aid to maintain the same sort of basic relation, right, colonial power and colony, while, again, sort of pushing off the demands for independence to some uncertain date in the future, rather than what so many in the colonies want, which is a much more rapid and meaningful form of self-determination.
Now, the altruistic framing of that project is if we, through our benevolent rule, deliver for these colonies, maybe they won't be so eager for independence. But the actual project, particularly when it's focused on monetizable economic activity, is how do we move the territories we currently govern away from an economy that is largely self-sufficient to one that is intertwined with, dependent on, and subordinate to our own?
That's right. And there's a really interesting set of tensions that emerge around the era of decolonization and the path that post-colonial independence would take, in part because many post-colonial leaders and those that are active in independence movements will ultimately use the same accounting framework, will use GNP in a similar way to the way in which the colonial powers do. One of the really remarkable facets of the mid-20th century is that pretty much every country in the world, in the capitalist world, ends up using GNP to describe their national economic life. What's interesting is that there are real kind of structural reasons why this is so on the one hand, but there's also some genuine desire on the part of many post-colonial leaders to embrace GDP as well. And let me explain that, both those sort of forces in turn. On the structural side, many of the new international organizations that are set up in the mid-20th century actually require GNP numbers for various purposes. The United Nations, for instance, determines the membership dues, how much a country owes to the UN as a condition of membership. They calculate that on a basis of GNP, as a percentage of GNP. And so many countries first get formal GNP estimates to be able to join the UN to determine how much they have to pay. Likewise, the World Bank determines loan repayment rates in the 1950s and 1960s by estimates of GNP. And so if you have a really low GNP, you have a more favorable loan repayment rate than if you have a comparatively higher GNP. And so countries need to be able to create GNP figures and update them in order to get World Bank loans and be able to know how much they have to pay back to the World Bank as part of those loans. And so those are some of the structural reasons at play. On the flip side, though, one of the really important pieces of the story that I tell is that in the mid-20th century, GNP growth was just incredibly popular, not only because it seemed to describe a set of positive trends, especially in Western Europe, the United States, and Japan after World War II. That is to say, in those countries, it seemed that GNP growth was increasing rapidly and leading to an improvement in people's material circumstances. But across much of the post-colonial world, leaders saw that and wanted to emulate it. And they believed that by pursuing high GNP growth rates, high national economic growth, they could overcome the experience of exploitation and oppression that had so characterized the colonial experience. And so many post-colonial leaders in Asia, East Asia, South Asia, Africa, and the Middle East want really high GNP growth rates, in part because they believe it will generate a more prosperous future for them and their countries. Across the global South in the 1960s and 1970s, there emerge all sorts of arguments against GNP from important thinkers, former planners, economists, and others, who argue, on the one hand, that national economic growth did not generate the widespread prosperity that so many had promised. And this argument is made most forcefully and frequently by a Pakistani economist named Maqbool ul Haq, who's really influential in development circles in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Haq had actually been really involved in Pakistan's planning in the 1950s and 1960s. He'd actually been really involved in writing the country's second five-year development plan. But by the late 1960s, what Haq comes to realize is that even though Pakistan had had high GNP growth rates, the benefits of that growth had been distributed in a wildly unequal way. And he gives a famous speech in Karachi in early 1968, where he argues that it seems that the 22 richest families in the country had sort of gathered most of the wealth, and that most of the GNP growth of the previous decade had unjustly gone to them, and that much of the rest of the country still faced real dire poverty. And so what Haq and many others across the global South began to argue is that development needed to cease focusing on increasing GNP at all costs, under the naive belief that it would necessarily trickle down to benefit everyone, and instead more directly target inequality, more directly target poverty, more directly seek to give people meaningful work, again, rather than just relying that GNP growth would naturally raise all boats equally. It's one of the criticisms that you start to see in the 1960s around GNP growth. But there are many others as well. Across Western Europe, the United States, Japan, and indeed in even part of the communist world within the Soviet Union and its allies, there is a widespread belief that by the 1960s that high economic growth has not led to social harmony. And in fact, high economic growth, a focus on productivity and production, has led to something like social alienation. And there's a lot of overlap in the arguments you hear coming out of countercultural voices, critical theorists, and the like, that say the sort of mindless pursuit of economic growth was meant to generate widespread economic prosperity, which in turn would generate a world of widespread social well-being, and that was just not the case. There was widespread social unrest, a sense of purposelessness, and also a real sense of injustice and inequality. In the United States, you see those arguments manifest in a number of different ways. You see lots of arguments from civil rights activists who point to the unjust distribution of benefits between, say, white and black people in the United States. Martin Luther King Jr., for instance, often speaks about how African Americans often live in poverty amidst a sea of plenty generated by economic growth. You often see in this time many feminists making the types of arguments we've discussed about the ways in which economic growth tended to reinforce and trickle down to male breadwinners rather than women. And you also see a kind of widespread generational gap, where many of those just coming of age in the 1960s and 1970s argue that the pursuit of economic growth is something that has benefited their parents' generation at their own expense. Many feel like they have done all of the right things, gone to school, done their homework and that sort of thing in the hopes of landing a good job, only to find that that job did not generate the kind of meaning and purpose they were looking for. This is also the era when you get a lot of environmental critics of economic growth, who point out in really profound ways that economic growth relied on all sets of flawed assumptions about the natural world. On the one hand, that the natural world had no fundamental limits to how far economic growth would go, And there was a real set of fears in the 1970s that the world was actually going to run out of vital resources because they were being used up so quickly. In addition, there was a widespread realization that economic growth came with real obvious costs. Air and water pollution, chemical runoff from factories creating all sorts of negative effects, the use of pesticides and fertilizers that turned out to be toxic and harmful to human health, all of which had contributed to the economic boom of the late 1940s, 1950s, and early 1960s, but now seem to create these real visible signs of the downsides of economic growth. And these environmental critics would point to these sorts of issues to indicate that not only did economic growth rest on this sort of set of flawed assumptions about the natural world, but that it was actually harming human well-being by posing serious health threats as well. And so in many ways, what had begun as a kind of few critics, a few voices crying out in the wilderness against this consensus around economic growth in the mid-20th century, became something of a mainstream phenomenon when you get to the 1970s.
I think there's probably two different strains or two different directions that goes that we should tease out. Like, one is a general critique of growth as a social project. The other is a kind of very technocratic green capitalism turn that says, well, if the problem is our calculation of GNP only attributes value to a forest when we cut it down and mill it into lumber, then we need to come up with a precise accounting for the ecosystem services it provides to the air, to the water, to the fisheries, and so forth, while it's still standing. Like, the answer is a better metric for tracking growth, not necessarily a rethinking of the growth project itself.
Yeah, and that's a really powerful tension among environmental critics of growth that you just touched on. And I think you see it in a couple ways. And so what you're referring to with the idea that, you know, when you cut down a forest and export it for timber, it's good for GNP, but now a forest is no longer there. That becomes referred to as the natural capital problem. And by the 1970s, and especially in the 1980s and 1990s, a number of environmentalists begin to use economic methods to try to account for the value of the fact that that forest is no longer there. This leads to, as you said, what's known as ecosystem services, or suggesting, again, using economic metaphors, that the natural world provides a set of services, quote unquote, that we can price into our economic models. For many sort of ecologically minded economists, and there is a whole school of thought called ecological economics, this provides a way to get the quote-unquote right incentives in place. And that is to say that it's not ipso facto necessarily a detrimental thing for a forest to be cut down, just so long as it's properly accounted for and monetized, that people can read prices as signals to determine whether or not exporting timber for lumber is worthwhile in a given situation. Again, this is a very kind of economic way of thinking. But there's a totally different strand of environmental critique that argues that this is simply the wrong way to go about doing this altogether, in part because it cedes a lot of what should be moral terrain to economists and economic ways of thinking. And so in this line of argument, what you see from critics is saying that rather than trying to price that forest and to express its value in monetary terms, we should instead express its value in moral terms, that the forest is beautiful to look at. It provides all sorts of value for those of us who like to go for walks in the woods. Likewise, that we have a moral obligation to protect the planet on its own terms. And that by not cutting down that forest, we might lose some timber for export, but a forest still stands. And so its value to us, not only as people, but to the value of all the non-human creatures and organisms that live and make use of that forest, get to remain in place as well. And what these sorts of environmental critics argue is that to cede this moral ground and these moral arguments to economic forms of reasoning and argumentation is basically to give up the game, which is to say, to not question whether GNP growth is good in and of itself, but rather to just ensure that GNP growth takes place with some degree of greenwashing, and to suggest that the way to go about generating better environmental outcomes is solely to basically integrate everything into a giant marketplace.
And to place a lot of faith in the market to then distribute that natural capital in a manner that's just. I mean, if one of the foundational critiques of growth is, hey, it seems to be making a handful of rich people insanely wealthy and not doing much for everyone else. If you can add like oceans and forests to the capital that markets are able to distribute, that could lead to a pretty dystopian future.
Yeah, and not only that, it also has a mythical view of what a market is, in part because it treats a market as a kind of hermetically sealed thing that is separate from all sorts of other social judgments, including the judgments of politicians, which is often not the case, right? Prices don't emerge naturally. They're determined by human choices. To give it just a great recent example of just how wild the pricing of the natural world can be. A great example of this is the what's called the social cost of carbon, which is the main way in which governments attempt to account for the monetary costs of climate change. Because we know that the carbon emissions that we put into the atmosphere now will not contribute to climate change tomorrow, but they will contribute to climate change in the future. And so while we might get some benefit by spewing carbon into the atmosphere today, it will have all sorts of knock-on effects in the past. Beginning in the late 2000s and early 2010s, governments began to try to account for this fact by putting a price on carbon, what they call the social cost of carbon. And the Obama administration set it at around initially about $50 a ton. When the Trump administration came into office, one of the first things they did is basically put it down to zero. And so overnight, the cost of carbon changed dramatically. And so what the Biden administration has done in the first few weeks that it has been in place is to raise the social cost of carbon back up to what it was beforehand. And so just in the last few years, the social cost of carbon has veered wildly between basically nothing and a relatively substantial amount because of the whims of who was in charge of the government at that place in time. And so that is not by any means the basis of a rational or fully functional marketplace. It shows you just how capricious things can be when we leave it up to the whims of the market and politicians to make these sorts of decisions about what is and is not valuable.
The thing I kept returning to over the course of your book was kind of a chicken and egg question. Does our idea of growth and of measuring growth through gross national product and later gross domestic product, does that just kind of reflect the economic order of the period that produced that idea? Or does the concept itself and the fact that we're measuring it and measuring our progress against it drive how we order our society?
That's a really great question. And I think it's helpful to have a historical perspective to begin to answer it. And I'll just talk a little about the ways in which I think through that problem, which is to say this. I think it's really significant that the phrase economic growth really takes off in the 1940s and 1950s, because in many ways that is an extremely exceptional period in history, not just the history of the United States, but in many ways the history of the world. And that's in large part because of the scale of devastation wrought first by the Great Depression and World War II. In many ways, for many parts of the world, in 1945, there was nowhere to go but up. That the scale of devastations and the opportunities posed by Reconstruction and rebuilding society were only going to generate really high GNP growth rates. And so in many ways, it's not all that remarkable that there was such high GNP growth in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, because there was simply a lot of economic work to do to get people fed, clothed, housed, working, and producing things again. That said, the historical conditions that produced economic growth in this really popular way in the mid-20th century have withered, and they're no longer with us. And yet, the pursuit of economic growth remains really central to the way in which people conceive of economic life, the way in which politicians talk about economic life, and the way in which policymakers plan for economic life in the future. And yet people's experience of economic growth is in many ways quite different, especially in this country, than it was in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And so to give one example, in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, average wage growth largely kept pace with national GNP growth rates. But beginning in the 1970s, and especially in the 1980s and 1990s, wage growth no longer keeps pace with national economic growth. And so in that sense, to talk about national economic growth no longer resonates in the same way that it once did. More broadly, though, there's another interesting question, which is to what extent talking about national economic growth is synonymous with talking about capitalism more broadly. And I think that that both is and is not the case. It is the case in part because of the triumph of capitalism over the last 30 years. And it's not the case in part because for much of the 20th century, there was a real viable alternative to capitalism, that of Soviet communism. And yet the Soviet Union spoke of economic growth, celebrated growth rates, prioritized growth accounting in very similar ways to the United States. Growth was just as much an imperative for the Soviet Union and its allies as it was for the United States and its allies. Again, what's distinctive about the last 30 years is that as that alternative, right, that sort of widespread alternative vision for how to organize one's political and economic life has faded from view, there is this renewed sense, once again, that growth is in fact synonymous with capitalism, and that to simply pursue economic growth measured in GDP is simply to reinforce basic elements of the capitalist economy.
Well, I think I'd like to end then talking about current politics, because there seem to be a couple interesting twists in recent times. One is you could pitch the child tax credit payments coming out of the American Recovery Plan as some kind of policy level acknowledgement of that unwaged domestic work you just described, child care, which would have stunned me a year ago if you told me it would happen in less than a year in the United States. The other is like the left wing of American politics kind of coalescing around a program of pursuing a Green New Deal, which seems to be threading a course between the anti-growthism of the 1970s and the technocratic green capitalism that came out of the same critique. It's saying, you know, let's reorder productive activity around meeting social and environmental needs, not do growth for the sake of growth, but also not just try to tweak the measurement so the market can solve our problems for us.
Yeah, and I think this is a really interesting moment. I mean, one of the arguments I make in the book is that the growth critics sort of broke through in the 70s, in part because it was an era in which people experienced limits to growth on a wide scale. And so as a result, for instance, of the oil embargo in 1973, people could no longer just drive their cars whenever they wanted to. They had an experience with material scarcity that made the growth critics' arguments resonate in some way. I think what we've seen over the last decade in American politics has generated a similar moment of opportunity for new ways of thinking. I agree with you. I could not have imagined something like these child tax credits being paid up front. Just could not imagine that being something that the Democratic Party embraced even 12 months ago. I think if anything, you know, we can even take this back a little bit further, that so much of this American recovery plan that the Biden administration has now successfully gotten passed through Congress, so much of it to me is unthinkable without the political campaigns first mobilized around Occupy Wall Street And then within the the presidential campaigns of Senator Bernie Sanders, both in 2016 and 2020. And I say that in part because what's interesting is that both Occupy Wall Street and the Sanders campaigns were mobilized in large part through statistics other than GNP. And here I'm thinking of the 99% versus the 1%, to put income distribution and wealth distribution as front and center in political and economic discourse. And I think we can see from those movements, and indeed from the way in which this really remarkable piece of legislation, that those had real purchase. They spoke to people in a visceral way, and politicians responded. I also think the discussion around the Green New Deal is a really interesting one, in part because the way in which the Green New Deal is presented generates a lot of backlash from the right as being anti-growth and being contrary to good economic principles, when in fact its primary selling point is that it provides a way to keep the growth paradigm going by investing in new technologies, new sources of energies that will create new jobs, that new investments in energy infrastructure will have multiplier effects that will generate increased economic activity down the line. And all of which I suspect is in fact true. There's a more radical critique of the Green New Deal that has generated more support in places like Europe called degrowth. In French, it's called décroissance. And the argument of degrowth activists is that things like the Green New Deal often play into the hands of the growth paradigm, of the status quo, and do too little to challenge the real sort of fundamental forces at play, the multinational corporations, the wealthy investors and the like, and also the basic lifestyle choices, the notion that we should be able to, and that it's natural and healthy to be able to say, you know, in central Indiana where I live, get fresh blueberries at the grocery store every single week of the year. That it represents an especially unsustainable form of living, and that rather than trying to create a Green New Deal when we can do all of this and just have it fueled by non-fossil fuel activities, that we should really rethink in a fundamental way how we live, how we relate to one another, how we relate to the natural world, and in many ways calling for a complete reorientation of priorities and values. And they'll critique the Green New Deal on those grounds. Indeed, in many ways, you know, the promise of having low growth and stagnating was once held up as a kind of positive outcome. One of the kind of earliest theorists of the benefits of a so-called stationary state economy, which is to say in contrast to an economy that's constantly growing, was the political economist John Stuart Mill. You know, who wrote a few hundred years ago that something along these lines would not be terrible, and that in fact, in mature societies and really advanced economies, you should shoot for economic stagnation, because people's needs could be met without increased productivity or demands on one's work, so that people could then spend their time engaging in what really mattered in life, which is to say, in leisure, in creative endeavors, in forging meaningful, lasting social relationships outside the framework of our economic lives.
Well, Steve Massacura, I think we have satisfyingly degrown our narrative arc from the Green New Deal all the way back to John Stuart Mill, so we can leave it there. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was great to chat with you.
Stephen Massacura is an associate professor of international studies at Indiana University Bloomington's Hamilton Luger School of Global and International Studies. His new book is The Mismeasure of Progress: Economic Growth and Its Critics.